Welcome to the Creative South Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Frostholm. My guest this week is Anon Avital, a UX UI designer for Adorama in New York City. Anon and I sit down and chat about growing up in an extremely religious family in Israel, moving stateside during high school and being saved in life by his uncle, Hebrew type, where he creates dimensional typography in Hebrew, and much more right after this. Are you ready to explore your creativity and meet a ton of new friends while you're doing it? Join us April 6th through 19th in Columbus, Georgia for Creative South, where you come as friends and leave as family. Head over to creativesouthga.com and get your tickets now for the greatest creative conference this side of the Mississippi. Plus, keep listening to the podcast for more exclusive news on CS17 speakers, events, and workshops coming soon. If you like the podcast and want to help support us, head over to patreon.com/creativesouth. Every dollar helps us cover hosting costs, upgrade equipment, and keep the podcast going. When you become a Creative South patron, you get access to exciting Creative South news before anyone else, Creative South podcast stickers and t-shirts, and you could even get your own podcast episode. So please help support the podcast by becoming a patron over at patreon.com/creativesouth. Anon, thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be on.
I'm excited to have you. So let's dive right in. Where'd you grow up?
You know how much I love this question.
Yes.
Right? I think that was the first thing I ever said to you personally at Creative South.
Yeah.
Right? We broke bread over that question.
Yeah.
Or actually, we broke chocolate over that question.
Yeah, exactly.
Not
chocolate
bread.
With Pop Rocks.
The Pop Rock chocolate is so, so good. The Pop Rock chocolate. Kind of like a friend of mine introduced me to it, and he said, whenever you go to a conference, bring that along with you. Everybody will be your friend.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's a great icebreaker, too, because you don't expect that. So.
Exactly. I mean, going around with adults and you're saying, here, be a kid again for a second. Who could say no to that, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I will take chocolate or really any type of candy anytime somebody offers it.
Noted.
Probably not a good thing.
I won't tell your wife, but noted.
Yeah. She's not going to turn it down either.
So I grew up in, actually rather, I was born in Brooklyn. I didn't grow up there for most of my life, but... So I was born to a father who is Israeli, who, after serving in the army, did a lot, what a lot of Israelis do. He traveled the world, and then he ended up in Brooklyn, where he married my mom. My mom was born to Israeli immigrants who moved here earlier on to make money, because they couldn't make money in Israel, so they came over here. My grandfather opened up a piano shop. He was a piano tuner for many years. So... the environment that I grew up in was very Israeli-oriented. So much so that my mom finally, when I was 7 years old, convinced my dad to go back to Israel. Because she was raised in America, in Brooklyn, and it was her dream to go back there, or rather to go there and live. And my father, coming from there, wanted to be in America because he loved America so much.
And of course, she won.
And she won. It took many years, but eventually we were seven kids at the time. So I'm the third oldest of then seven. Now,
oh, bless your
11.
Mother's heart.
Yes. Bless her a million times over. It is intense.
Yeah.
I cannot imagine doing that myself.
No, no.
It's unbelievable. I mean, I'm the third from the top, right? So I'm the third oldest. And... we have a family that big. Everybody's taking care of each other. You know, the older ones are helping with the younger ones, that sort of a thing. So, you know, bless my mother's heart, but bless all of our hearts.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing.
Yeah.
It's a shared burden for everybody. Right?
I can imagine, yeah. So you moved to Israel. How old were you when you moved to Israel?
I was seven.
So you're seven. Okay. So you're seven when you moved to Israel. Was that a bit of a culture shock for you? I mean, I realize you grew up in an Israeli family and raised that way, but it is a different country. So there is, you know, Got to be some sort of culture shock. I mean, at seven, it's kind of hard to notice, too. So, right.
I honestly have so few memories from when I was a little kid. I really, I guess it's weird because people that I've met later on in life, you know, keep on bringing up stories from when they were super young, but I don't remember much. I remember, you know, a few, you know, fleeting cold moments from terrible winters, which I'm back to right now, and I hate, by the way. But because I grew up in this Israeli household, moving there was really not much of a big deal. I immersed right away. I became part of, you know, the culture. I made friends. I spoke the language. So it was pretty good, actually. Not bad at all.
Gotcha.
On my mom, it was hard because my father had a year of transition where he wasn't there. But other than that, it was a perfectly fine transition.
Sure.
Now, the place I grew up in was extremely religious. So you know how there's a range for religiosity from not religious at all to extreme fanaticism?
Yes, right? Yes.
Like, really bad. I'm not going to name anybody because I don't want to say anything bad, but there is
extreme fanaticism. Oh, it runs the gambit in all different religions, so.
Every religion has this, yes. Right? Same thing happens in Judaism. Yes, I'm Jewish. Yeah. And I am from a family who's at the close to the extreme fanatic end.
Yeah.
Not quite there, you know, but what that means is I didn't have any TV, no pop culture, no books, no nothing, very secluded.
Sure.
Only talk to girls who are immediate family, that sort of a thing.
Which is great when you're a teenager, I'm sure.
Well, I didn't know any better.
Yeah, but hormones don't stop happening.
Oh, no, that's the end.
I mean, yes. Hormones are biological. Religion doesn't matter when it comes to that.
And you know even less what to do with it, which can be good, but it's definitely bad.
Yeah, that runs the whole gamut. So, getting back to that.
Well, you went there.
No, it's true. Everybody was a teenager at some point.
Yes, everybody understands, just a little bit. So, this religious environment meant that the old boys' school, of course, that I went to, was a place where they also didn't teach almost any secular studies past the third or fourth grade. There was nothing. They taught us math up until then, and they taught us a few other subjects, but in later years, starting with fifth grade and going forward, they tried to teach us some math and, for some odd reason, geography, but no other subjects were taught, and the teachers who came there always had this attitude of, it doesn't really matter, you're not going to need this later on in your life, so we knew not to care about that, to the extent that we learned literally nothing.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did learn was, you know, Talmud, Bible, and religious studies all day long. Or at least pretended to, because on those things, we didn't even have tests. So there were no consequences. So for a kid like me, who didn't really care about the material so much, I pretty much learned nothing in elementary school.
So, as a kid, that would have been my dream. As an adult, I look at that and I cringe.
Exactly. It sounds like a fantasy. And mind you, my father taught in this school, and my best friend there, his father was the chief rabbi of the school.
Mm-hmm.
So we were both in a similar boat. We hated learning, and we caused a ton of trouble, and it was a gag at the time, right? We had so much fun doing whatever we wanted, getting into trouble, getting it covered up by our awesome dads, right? But looking back, it was so much wasted time where I literally learned nothing. No biology, no sense of self, no thinking, no nothing. I was a baby when I finished elementary school.
Sure.
Pretty much. And the expected life path in that community is after you finish this elementary school, you go to what's called small yeshiva, quote unquote. And that's kind of like high school, where it's the same thing as elementary school. You learn just the religious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even bother trying to teach you secular studies at that point.
Mm-hmm.
They don't even make an attempt. It's like, all right, we're done. You know, we pretended earlier on, and now we don't have to do it at all. And most of the people who go to small yeshiva do it out of town. So by high school,
so it's kind of like a boarding school?
It's boarding school.
Yeah.
Right away. And after those 3 years, the expected path is to go to a high yeshiva until you get married, young, right? Because of those hormones.
Yes.
Got to solve that problem somehow. And once you're done with high yeshiva, or rather get married, you go to something called kollel, which is the same thing as yeshiva. You just get a small stipend for payment so you can pretend to support your family.
So help me understand, how do they expect people, once they get out, to have a job? Because not everyone can be a rabbi.
They don't.
So they
just don't. They expect for you to sit down and learn for the rest of your life. There are a few people who are really not good at learning. It doesn't click. And for those select few, they go on to get pretty simple jobs that make the money, like being a plumber and electrician and things like that.
Trade jobs.
Trade jobs, that's what it's called, right? See, my English is still not great. So there's a small subset of people who will go on to do that, but that's not expected. That's the exception. And so for somebody who can clearly learn, I could learn, you know, I was proven
just
not
didn't
want
to learn the stuff that was being taught.
Exactly. And so I didn't fit in, clearly. At all.
Sure.
And that expected life path was not something I wanted at all for myself.
Was that something your parents wanted for you, or was that something that your parents did because your dad taught at the school?
It's neither. It's really? Just what everybody in the community was expected to do.
That's what the culture was in that that particular community.
Exactly. And if you go any other way, it's kind of shameful for your family.
Sure.
And if it's shameful for your family, they have a hard time finding finding spouses.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you're in a family where somebody wasn't going along the regular path, then the family had a bad name and nobody wanted to marry you. Now, being a family of 11 kids, that was a very, very big problem that they didn't want to have.
Yeah.
So
at what point, because obviously you have some education,
I do.
Learn things. You are in a field where math comes in pretty handy. I mean, yes. Granted, you're on the artistic side of it, so, you know, it's not like you're having to run calculus algorithms all the time, but at what point do you either say to your parents, or do your parents decide, you know, Anand needs to be doing something else?
It didn't come from my parents,
okay.
Actually. It came from my family in America, which is how I got here. I'm in America now.
Sure.
The small yeshiva, the high school that I went to was first in Jerusalem. I didn't learn anything. I was a very bad boy. They kicked me out. They sent me to a lesser one where more troublesome kids are.
Yeah.
I was a bad boy there too. They kicked me out. And again and again, I went to several places where everyone was for less. I'm going to put quotes on this one, lesser and lesser kids, because we were just kids who didn't fit into the system. We weren't really bad. We were just forced to be in the system. So by the time I left Israel, I was in a place that was an absolute dump where there was almost no supervision. It was a rat-infested party house where we were there just to be kept.
That just sounds like college. That sounds like my first year of college.
Right, but no degree.
No, well, that. After my first year of college, there was a very extended break, so.
I want to hear more about that.
Oh, I'll fill you in. Don't worry.
Please
so,
do.
Yeah, so the rat-infested party house, and you obviously are not comfortable with that.
I was fine with it because I had no other choice, and I didn't want to learn, so I was at a place where I didn't have to learn at all, and they were fine with me playing games all day long and going out and doing whatever I wanted. Mm-hmm. But that was not a life path. It was just a holding pen.
Sure.
Now, my family in America, my mother still has 3 siblings here, saw what I was going through, and they decided to bring me here. Apparently, they keep on saying I'm the loved one. You know, there's 11 kids in my family, but I'm their star child. No, I'll take it. And they saw that I was doing so poorly, they wanted to bring me here and kind of fix me up, so to speak. So April 2001, This was before 9/11.
Sure.
My mom called up when I was at that rat-infested place. And she asked me, do you want to go to America for a little while? I said, sure, I'll go to America for a little while. I had nothing better going on, right? I'll do it.
Yeah.
No problem. And she said, you'll go in 2 months. Are you okay with that? I said, I don't care when I go.
Sure.
I'll go whenever. I talked to my friends about it. And I distinctly remember that we had a conversation where everybody was just so jealous of me that I got to go to the land of money on trees. Like, that was, like, the thought. Because I remember I had no education. And
can you find me that neighborhood, by the way?
I'm still looking.
Yeah.
But at the time, I was really excited because that's what America was. It was memories of cold and money on trees somewhere. Mm-hmm. Very exciting. So, of course, I was going to say yes to that. And, of course, all my friends were jealous. And so, in May or that year or something like that, it was towards the end of the school year, I was sent on a plane. I was 16 years old. Mm-hmm. And they put me on a plane with $20.
Oh, big money.
Right. I had $20 in my pocket, a few shirts, mm-hmm. and that's it. It was like a tiny little suitcase, and I came, and they said, your uncle will meet you at the airport. So I flew into JFK, and my uncle was a little bit late.
Oh, no.
So it was kind of in a strange country with $20, a phone number to call in case he didn't come in a few hours. And eventually he came, and this uncle, I pretty much owe him my life.
Mm-hmm.
So my mom's siblings decided to bring me to America, but he was the one who actually put me in his house.
Mm-hmm.
He had one son. He was divorced, and he had one son, so it was a pretty empty house, and he had time to help me out.
Mm-hmm.
And he made me into his son.
Mm-hmm.
He fed me. He sent me to high school. He paid for everything I needed. And he also eventually not only taught me to be a human being,
mm-hmm.
but to also be a thinking human being.
Mm-hmm.
Right, because I never got any of that. And so I came to America, and a few days after I was here, my uncle said, okay, you had your time to relax. Let's go talk to some people in the high school, in the local high school. So this mm-hmm. is also a Jewish high school. It's a private one, but it's not at all the same as the yeshivas I was at in Israel. This
sure.
was a kind of place where you had a regular education, and on top of the regular high school education, you also had some religious studies.
Right, it's
the proper thing to do.
It's for, and I'm not Catholic, but it's the Jewish version of Catholic school.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a parochial right. school.
They prepare you for life, and
yeah.
they teach you the religion that they want you to know and believe
yeah.
in, and have faith in.
That's a smart way to do it.
Exactly, it's the appropriate way to do it. And so when I went to the school, I didn't realize at the time that I was being interviewed. My English was awful then.
Mm-hmm.
So I chatted with a few of the administrators in Hebrew, and it was fine. And after we left the school, my uncle asked me, how do you like the school? I said, it's fine. What do you mean? He said, well, would you like to go to the school? I said, what do you mean? I'm just here for a visit. He said, no. You're here to stay, buddy. And that's when I found out that they sent me to America to stay.
Mm-hmm.
I ended up going to that school, but before I went, they made me take 4 or 5 months, the entire summer length of English and math courses to kind of catch me up.
Sure, kind of remedial courses to get you up to speed as much as possible.
Exactly. So I had private tutoring for a while, and that's all I did mm-hmm. until I went to school in the fall. And I did pretty well in math. I was terrible in English.
Mm-hmm.
So much so, I remember after my very first test, I got a 12, I think, on the test.
That's impressive. That's impressive.
Exactly. For an immigrant, not too bad for a first test. But I was frustrated, not because of the score that I got, because I didn't, at the time, still care about tests, because I
sure.
grew up not caring about tests. I was just annoyed that there were so many words in English. So, I asked the teacher in the middle of the class, why are there so many words in English?
Because
and
we
of course,
speak
everybody
English
laughed.
In America.
Right. But it was just, not just there are so many words, but why are there so many words that describe something that can be said with other words. I was so bothered by it at the time.
English is a tough language, so.
Very tough. But I got laughed at then. And because I got laughed at, that actually helped me to learn a lot faster. Because every time I'd said something that was totally off, and people laughed at me all the time. There was no shame. People made fun of me a lot. Mm. It just pushed me harder to learn better. And so by the time I finished high school, I did really well on my SATs. Mm-hmm. And I was great in English. And my math was fantastic. They put me in higher levels of math. I mean, I ended up succeeding pretty fine at school.
Yeah.
I learned plenty. Now, when I finished high school, I had a choice to either go back to Israel mm-hmm. to do the mandatory army service, because that is something that's mandatory there. Everybody has to go serve when you're 18.
Sure.
Or I could choose to stay here and go to college. So I said to my uncle, how about I sign up for one college, try to get in. If I get in, I'll go. If not, I'll go back. And thank you very much for everything you did for me. Mm-hmm. I applied to a place called Mason Gross. It's the art school in Rutgers in mm-hmm. New Jersey.
I have a certificate of web application development from Rutgers.
How interesting. Is this yeah. something you did online?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've never been to Rutgers. I've been to a rest area and a hotel and an IKEA in Jersey. That's, you know.
Wait, the IKEA is right around from me. You've been to my neighborhood.
Yeah.
How cool.
Yeah.
So I ended up going to Rutgers. I got in to this uh-huh. the small class. And I think part of why I got into this art school, because it was one of those places where thousands of people applied and they only accepted 60-odd something people every year. Mm-hmm. But part of the entry exam was kind of a presentation where you put up some paintings on the wall and everybody had a section filled up with all sorts of work. Mine only had three poor little things on there. And I also had an opportunity to attach a letter, and in that letter, I wrote boo-hoo, poor me, sort of a story. I grew up not knowing anything, and I just want to learn with all these amazing professors. So I'm pretty sure they kind of saw me as a minority, and they were like, all right, let's take this kid. Let's nurture him. Let's put him in there. And so I got in, which was amazing, and I said, okay, screw you, Army. Shh, don't tell him I said that. And
it's the Israeli army, you know, they're known for being kind and gentle to people. So,
oh, PC. So good. So I got in and I went there and I decided to concentrate on painting, which is totally useless.
Yes, yeah.
Right, but being the kind of person that I was, where I just wanted to get a degree for the sake mm-hmm. of getting a degree, and my amazing uncle was also paying for this, mm-hmm. I said, you know what, let me choose the easiest path through and just get a degree in playing around. Mm-hmm. Right? And junior of that year, of that experience, I met my wife, and then mm-hmm. I got married, like pretty much right away. So before I finished college, I was already married.
See, those hormones were still going on.
I'm seeing a theme developing over here.
I'm just picking on you. But yeah, so junior year, you meet your wife, you get married.
I got married
really
right.
quickly.
Very quick. And I have to start providing as soon as I was done with college, because I was still being supported by my uncle
sure.
through college. And then once I was done, I had to get a job. So
that's generally how it works.
It's pretty much. But I was a painter.
Yeah.
I picked the wrong degree.
I got lucky early on because I wanted to be, when I got back in college, I wanted to do painting as a major. And I quickly realized that, A, I was not really that good at painting. And I didn't like the professor, especially one of the professors who was teaching painting, and all of the other professors were getting ready to retire. So I was like, I got to do something else. And I was always kind of a nerdy kid anyways. And so playing on computers and getting to do art seemed really awesome. So that's how I got into graphic design. I really didn't know anything about it. When I was in high school, I wanted to do advertising, but didn't know what you did with that or really anything other than, hey, there's cool commercials during the Super Bowl. So when I went to college when I went back to college, because there was a almost 4-year break in there, I did the painting thing, and I did a semester where it was my declared major, and just realized really quickly that I wasn't good at it, and I enjoyed it, but there was no way I was going to make a living, especially as, you know, not only because you're a painter, but as lack of discipline and talent that I had within the world of painting, there was just no way. So,
I mean, you almost should go back and thank that professor for being so terrible because he helped you get a career.
If I can never see her again, it will be too soon. I have more friends that I know who started off as art majors and left and are now doing jobs that they hate because she ran them off from art.
Oh, that's actually awful.
Yeah.
It worked out for you, but that's...
It worked out for me because I didn't want to give up art. I just didn't want to be in her classes anymore. So, but now she doesn't teach at that college anymore, so she gets to teach at another college.
Oh, poor students.
Yeah. So, I mean,
yeah. Making money from painting, I remember a statistic that I'm probably saying incorrectly, said by my professor during sophomore year, this amazing professor, mm-hmm. very great artist, very different from your experience. I had fantastic teachers in art school. And she said something along the lines of, in New York City alone, just New York City, there are about 500,000 people who consider themselves to be painters. Mm-hmm. Out of those 500,000 people, I mean, a lot of them are probably amateurs, but still,
sure.
Out of 500,000 people, only about 1,000 actually make money off of this.
Sure.
I mean, that's a tiny, minuscule percent. And she was like, I know where you guys are at. I'm sorry to tell you this, but this is the reality. Mm-hmm. And so right away, I knew I wasn't going to be able to do anything with that. Mm-hmm. But I still kept on going through because I loved it. I liked creating things and I liked making paintings that I could give as gifts to my family and friends, right?
Sure.
Everybody loves that guy.
Yeah.
He gave me something to hang in my house. And all the people who I gave things to still have it hanging till nowadays. So for that, it was worthwhile.
Yeah.
I also took one course in there that taught me how to do bookbinding. So I'll talk about something that I'm doing with books a little bit later on, mm-hmm. but there was actually something extremely valuable that I got out of the college career. Not to make fun of all of it.
Yeah.
Just most of it.
Well, I mean, I will say, so the one thing, like, about college is if you do college right, it's not necessarily about the subject you're learning. It's about it teaches you how to learn on your own. Or it should, if it's done right.
It also teaches you how to think about certain things. So, for example, sure, my job now is in design, mm-hmm. but painting taught me a lot of color principles and mm-hmm. layout and mm-hmm. how to look at different things, perspectives, and so on. Political thinking also, which applies to general design work. So sure. There was definitely a lot of thinking that I can still apply to mm-hmm. my current work.
Yeah,
it's just the very specific nature of how I execute that thinking is irrelevant now, which is fine. You know, I had my fun and it's over. It's fine. Maybe I'll paint again one day. I don't know. I'm not doing it anymore, but
I mean, you can still do stuff. It's, you just have to do stuff for you now. And
yes, if I had 40-hour days, oh man, I would be recording music. I would be painting. I would be napping more. I would be playing, you know, Rummy Cue with my kids more. I'd be doing a lot more.
Yeah.
Yes.
So getting back, junior year, you've gotten married. And you quickly realize I'm going to have to provide for my family.
Oh yeah, money.
Yeah. So what did you do then?
Throughout college, I had this side job where I was working at this shoteka shop, which is a place that sells, you know, Jewish paraphernalia.
Yeah.
Not far from me. And
not to be confused with a head shop, which sells other paraphernalia.
Right, which I also love. Big fan of both.
Yeah.
Didn't get an opportunity to work at the other kind. But the Judaica shop is a place where I worked not far from me, and I built them some websites. And after college, they said, okay, we'll hire you for a bit. Mm-hmm. We want you to help us grow our sales division of some sort. I don't remember exactly what it was.
Sure.
Turns out, I'm an awful salesman.
I am too.
Really bad. I mean, I can talk to, you know, people who are friendly to the face and kind of have a nice conversation and maybe sell them a pin or two, mm-hmm. looking at you.
Thank you. I wore one to work the other day.
Awesome. But to cold call, you know, people who don't want to talk to you and to try to sell them stuff, that feels dirty, it's not fun, and it's something that I never want to have to try to do ever again in my life.
Sure.
So they hired me for that. I was bad at it, but I was still building them these amazing websites, which was fine for them. And as soon as those websites were live and making them money, they said, thank you, and goodbye.
I've had a few clients like that.
So that was it. It was fine. It wasn't making me a tremendous amount of money, that job. It was kind of a starter job. So it was the perfect opportunity for me to move on. And thankfully, very quickly, I found my current job. So I work at Adorama right now. And if you don't know, Adorama is a camera equipment store, very similar to B&H. Not only are they similar, both companies are owned by cousins. It's a whole family.
So is this like a weird family rivalry, or do they get along just fine?
It's not a rivalry.
Okay.
For example, during Hurricane Sandy, our store lost all electricity for a really long time, but B&H is further up north on the island, Manhattan, that they had electricity just fine. Happened to be, B&H also owned this massive generator, truck-size generator, and they were not going to say, you know, oh, screw you, we're going to make all the money now because you're down. They actually lent the generator to Adorama. It's a very friendly competition, in other words.
Gotcha.
They're not. I mean, they still, you know, rival to try to get all the clients for themselves, but it's not.
That's called business.
It's just business, right?
But they're able to separate that, so.
Definitely. And there's a lot of crossover. People who are, you know, bored with one company will go to the other one just because that's what they feel like doing. And it's happened plenty both ways.
I have spent thousands of dollars with both companies.
There you go. So, Adorama, they also own a few other companies. They have a scuba diving shop called Leisure Pro. They have an outdoor shop.
I didn't know that.
Called, very random, yes.
Yeah.
They have an outdoor shop called Sunny Sports, and they also have a rental business and a photo printing business. So,
do they just have shops for all their hobbies?
Not really. The owners are Satmar Hasidic Jews.
Oh, really?
I would venture to say there's probably nobody in the company who ever went scuba diving out of the religious group. And the outdoor stuff, maybe somebody bought some hiking boots because they didn't know better, but... It's not their hobbies, no. It was just one of those things where they wanted to grow and they wanted to try something else, see if it works. And they were the first scuba diving shop online, I believe. Don't hold me to it, but they claim that they were the first. So that was a big deal, and they ended up... We're still doing fine nowadays because they grew to be pretty big in that area. So I got a job there in 2008, I want to say, maybe 2009, almost a decade ago, doing brochures and catalogs and print design, layout work. That's something that I was able to pick up very quickly, even though I only officially learned painting. I knew how to use Photoshop, I knew how to use Illustrator and this and that. So I handled all that pretty fine, and also having built some websites at my previous job, when fixes were needed for the old Adorama website, which was horrible at the time. It was one of those things where we had a very, very small team kind of doing patchwork on a giant patchwork quilt that was stinky from, you know, 40 years ago at Woodstock sort of a thing.
Oh, I remember how bad it was a while back. It was really tough to navigate.
And I'm only pointing out how bad it is because of how amazing it is right now, right? I'm not going to just bad enough
Yeah, you'd like to keep your job.
The hand that feeds me. it was very bad back then, which meant that I was good enough to help maintain it.
Sure.
And from then on, I actually grew my skills and came all the way to where I am right now, which is the UX designer. I design... you know, wireframes for the website and improvements, and I actually code. Most of what I do is HTML and CSS all day long. So if anybody looks up on my social profiles, sure, I'll write in there, you know, coder or something, but you'll never be able to tell that that's what I do for a living.
Right.
But most of the day, I spend in front of a text editor just, you know, writing tags and writing these CSS. That's what I do all day long.
Gotcha. So... is that kind of how, you know, with the Hebrew type stuff that you do, did that come out of just needing something to do that was much more creative and not coding and, you know, getting back to an almost painterly style? you know, did that kind of come out of that, of just needing a project to do that was creative, or was there other reasons behind that?
Oh, you're right on the money with that. Definitely, 100%. It was just, when you're working for somebody else, and anybody listening to this who's a creative can totally relate to doing work for other people, where you do it because you can do it, you're creative, you can come up with ideas, solve their problems, but it's still not your work, and sometimes you'll have to go through changes that are not what you want to do, and it's just, it's not work for you.
Sure.
It's work for somebody else.
Sure.
And that's fine, pays the bills, which is the goal of a job, but I really wanted to get back to doing something for myself. And I wanted to do something beyond just coding. I love doing things with my hands. And the computer, yeah, I'm typing with my hands, but it's not the same.
No, it's not the same.
At all. And so it was about April of last year, so April 2015, that's when I started my Hebrew type adventure, I'd like to call it. And the reason why I picked Hebrew is because I knew I wanted to do something with my hands. I wanted to pick something simple that I could do for a while. So I decided I'm going to do simple ink lettering.
Sure.
Seems pretty easy. A lot of people do it.
Not as easy as it looks, is it?
Not at all. Totally not easy. And when I try to do English stuff nowadays, I'm awful at it. I could play around and get something that's okay, but it takes a lot of practice. I mean, I was sitting at Wells Collins workshop, which is where I met you. And actually,
Meg's workshop. I think.
So you weren't in Wells's.
No, I wasn't in Wells's. No, you. I know how bad I am at lettering stuff that I just stay away from it.
So you don't want to feel bad about yourself.
So, I may have been clearing out Wells's workshop.
Could be, because Meg's was right afterwards.
Yeah, so it was either, I don't know, it was either right after Meg's or right in between them.
Right. So. Towards the end of the workshop, in the middle of one of those, I heard your voice, and I still hadn't met you, and I had no idea what you looked like. And when you spoke, I said, oh, that voice! I know that voice! So, learning from that workshop and seeing the kind of brush lettering that Wells does. I mean, I know it's way beyond me. And I don't do brush lettering. Even in Hebrew, I attempted one thing and I posted, you know, a thing that I did right during that workshop at the time, but lettering is very hard. And because I'm proficient in Hebrew, and because there are so many people who do English lettering, I decided to pick Hebrew because I knew nobody else who does Hebrew lettering.
No.
I thought I must be the only one in the world doing that. So I said, ah! Something else to stand out in. You know, I'll experiment with something that nobody else is doing. But more importantly, when you have so many people doing something, it's so easy to look at their stuff and copy and then have the mistake of sharing what you've copied, which we all know now is a big no-no. It's fine to experiment with other people's stuff, but you don't share those things, right?
Right.
And I didn't want to have to go through that. I wanted to create my own stuff. So by picking a different language system, I had very little to copy off of. And my biggest challenge to myself, which you can see in my work, especially the more recent work, was to connect Hebrew letters in a more fluid way. Now, I don't know how much you know about Hebrew letters, but they are super rigid.
Yes.
And most of the ends don't lend themselves to extensions and connections. Like, there's one letter that's like a tiny little line that sits on the very top of the line, of the line. And if you extend it a little bit, it's another letter. And if you extend it a little bit more, it's a completely different letter. So I had this challenge of super rigid letters, and I said to myself, that's great. I'm going to play around with this stuff. There's nobody else doing it. I'm going to try to connect these things and play along. And I picked Song of Songs. The Hebrew version of Song of Songs, of course, to start lettering, because I had nothing else. I didn't have any words to write. I didn't know what to say. I had no voice yet. I was just starting to play around. And my Hebrew type adventure literally started with me lettering Song of Songs, different styles, and posting them. That was it. It was about 2 months later, so this actually started in February of 15, not April. In April of 15 was Passover. And this was a turning point for me because, sure, I was, you know, gaining more of a following online, especially on Instagram, and people were starting to pay attention, and I was making friends. But on Passover, it's both Passover and another holiday called Sukkot are 8 days long. And the way that it works is the first 2 days and the last 2 days are like a Sabbath, where you can't do anything. No driving, no writing, and that's just Jewish law. The in-between days in Passover are kind of like the other days, kind of not. You can do certain things, and you can't do other things. One of the things that you cannot do is write. You can't use a pen, you can't use ink, you're not supposed to write. Which was a problem for me. Because I just started getting the groove. It was 2 months in. I was already lettering. I was having fun. This was like an almost daily thing for me. And then came this 8 day period where I couldn't do anything. And it was so frustrating. So I looked around with what I had. And that was the very first time that I did what's known as food typography.
Sure.
Before I posted that food typography, I was looking around, and that's exactly when I found Danielle Evans, whose work is amazing.
I was about to ask.
But that was exactly the time when I met her online. And it was also the first time that I actually hesitated to post something because I just found out about her right after I made my piece, right before I posted mine. And I said to myself, oh, her work is so good. And what I made is just, I was so embarrassed by it. But I posted it anyways, and then I did another thing out of matzah that came out very cool. And for me, that was the turning point between just doing it to do it and doing it to push myself to get somewhere else. So the first food type thing that I did then that I didn't love was not good. I posted it anyway. But the very next one I did 2 days later, I still love it. Looking back a year now, I still think it was amazing.
Sure.
And at that time, another reason why I started to grow then was because I tweeted the thing at Danielle. I was like, oh, look at her stuff also. She's an inspiration for food type. And she started talking back to me. And she said, oh, this is so cool. You're doing it in a whole new language system. Do you have a website that I could share? And I was like, oh, website.
Oh, crap.
Right. That thing. Up until then, I was only putting it on Facebook for my friends, which is, you know, my actual, you know, real life friends, and on Instagram for people who are also becoming my friends, but general random audience. That was it. That's all I had. I was like, oh no, website, what am I going to do? So right away, I opened up a Tumblr, which was the fastest way to put up a website.
Sure.
I registered a domain and was like, oh, let's look through Google Domains because that's what I was using. And what do you have with HebrewType? .com's taken. Okay. .land. And because I was in a rush and the only thing that looked cool enough was HebrewType.land, I ended up just picking that, I put together the website, and I said, hey, Danielle, of course I have a website. Quote, unquote, I had it all along. It's HebrewType.land. And that's how I started my brand of HebrewType.land. She was very kind. She even wrote a blog post about it, not only shared it on Twitter and whatever it was, which brought a couple more people into my audience, and it just started growing from there.
Sure.
And because it was growing, I started experimenting more because I said to myself, okay, I got to take this a little bit more seriously. And I was going through this phase where I was kind of doing it more for the audience, less for myself. Right after that, I leaped into food typography because it was the cool new thing that I just discovered.
Right.
So I started doing this spicy typography, and I emptied my spice cabinet. I wrote the name of every spice in that. And by the time I finished that series, which was 2 months in, thankfully I kind of started innovating again and doing it less for the attention. I mean, of course, I still enjoy, you know, whatever interactions I get online.
Sure.
But from that project and posting all the spicy type, I actually started getting real work that was not web design work. Because I've been freelancing for years and doing web design work, but I also started to grow this Hebrew type brand, and people started wanting me to do Hebrew lettering for them, and it started becoming an actual business.
Makes it easy when you're a horrible salesperson, too.
Exactly. Well, it's the kind of situation where I don't have to sell myself because people see the work and they just come to me like, all right, we love it. What do you want? I'm paying you. Do it.
Yeah. So, you know, with the Hebrew type, you've gone from, you know, doing the letters to doing words and things like that. But you've also expanded and you've started offering products and things like that. And then, you know, we were talking beforehand about the books that you do. How did that come about?
Pretty straightforward, actually. Mm-hmm. I love doing Hebrew lettering, mm-hmm. and I still do it. But I put up a shop, actually, mm-hmm. sometime during the summer, because a lot of family and friends said they wanted to buy this spicy typography that I made. They just wanted to hang it in their kitchens and this and that. Mm-hmm. I said, cool, let me do that. I opened up a shop as an extension of my HebrewType.land website, mm-hmm. and I sold all the posters to them. And once everybody who wanted to buy it bought it, the posters stopped selling, because posters are such a hard sell.
Yeah, yeah.
For anybody. I mean, even if you're coolest art, they just stay, and unless somebody really loves it, or it's a limited edition of sorts, people really have to love it so much, paying that in their own home. So I sold all those posters to everybody, and then my shop went stale. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to start doing something else with it, because I had this whole avenue of revenue. Mm-hmm. Or potential revenue, at least.
Sure.
And I thought to myself, okay, what else can I do that people would actually buy on a regular basis? So I used the one thing that I learned in college that was actually really useful. I started making notebooks. Uh-huh. But this notebook thing has a slight short backstory. About 3 years ago, a good friend of mine and I were going to build this whole other brand and try to make a business out of it, mostly selling clothing and this and that, and we're also going to make these pocket notebooks. Uh-huh. So we spent a good half a year buying all sorts of equipment, you know, shears and corner rounders and fabrics and papers and all these things, and we experiment for a long time.
Okay, so when you say you're making shirts, I did not imagine literally, like, making shirts.
We weren't going to literally make shirts. What we were going to do is we're going to create these designs. He's a very good copywriter, so he wrote those things. I designed, you know, the lettering and whatever around those sayings.
Sure.
And in addition, we're going to make these notebooks that we're going to call Implaza books or something ridiculous like that. And that would be our actual handmade component. So these shirts would be a print-on-demand thing. Mm-hmm. And we ended up going pretty far, but it never actually took off because it wasn't something viable. Mm-hmm. We're still good friends, though. It wasn't one of those situations where our friendship was destroyed because of it.
That's good.
It's very good. And if we would have continued with the business, it might have not been the case. So
yeah,
that business idea shut down. But I still had all this equipment that we got for these books that we were going to make.
Sure.
So when I was thinking about a new thing to do with my Hebrew type shop, mm-hmm. I thought, notebooks, let's do that. And I just made a sampling of 24 notebooks, I think it was, the first one, and they each were with different covers, different styles, and I put them up for sale to see how they would do. Mm-hmm. I think it was 3 or 4 different designs, doesn't matter. They all sold out right away.
Oh, wow.
All those notebooks. I put up one design every day, so there was a week where so it was 4 designs, actually, because it was Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Every mm-hmm. day was one new design, and within minutes of putting it out, they all sold out mm-hmm. completely. I said, okay, I'm onto something over here. And I started creating larger production of the notebooks. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty much the story. I mean, I'm trying to think of what else there was to it, but it was just me creating this thing that people were interested in and that they would buy regularly.
Sure.
And you're asking in your head probably right now, how the heck does Hebrew type fall into these pocket notebooks? Because we're still in America, and unless I know a giant amount of Jews who want to write in Hebrew, who the heck would buy these notebooks, right?
Unless they're about 13 and getting ready for their bar mitzvah and yeah, doing that. I don't, yeah.
And 13-year-old boys are not known for their deep pockets.
Nor they're wanting to write things.
Exactly. Perhaps post bar mitzvah once they get all that money.
Yeah, right? lots of thank you notes. Lots of thank
you. So these books actually are just squeezed onto the Hebrew type umbrella. I have this shop that's mm-hmm. doing pretty fine. So I didn't want to open up a whole new shop that would sell these notebooks. It was a thought, but I decided to just put it into one place so that I have a centralized location, because when it comes to operations, it's just the smart thing to do.
Sure.
You want to have all your orders in one place, all your advertisements. You only keep on sharing a single URL everywhere. There's less distribution of
craziness. You don't have to manage a bunch of different things. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So my excuse of putting it under the Hebrew Type umbrella is twofold. Number one, all the notebooks are packaged so that it looks like you have to open it from right to left, because that's how you read Hebrew, right to left.
Mm-hmm.
In reality, they are direction agnostic. You can use them however you like. You can use them up and down and write them in, you know, Chinese if you'd like. But the packaging is done in the Hebrew right to left sort of a thing, or Arabic, same thing.
Sure.
And on top of that, every edition that I make, and by edition, I mean every edition is made of different color fabrics, different materials, different insides, different threads. These are all handmade and hand sewn. So an edition is just an experimentation with different materials to create a new style of notebook. So an edition is also accompanied by one notebook where on the cover I write something in Hebrew.
Mm-hmm.
I sell it for a little bit more money as the handwritten Hebrew one, and my pudding, right, which is fine. They all sold out, by the way, so far. People are into those. And that's my, you know, putting the Hebrew into the Hebrew type books.
Mm-hmm.
So it just kind of works under the same umbrella. Just fine.
Sure. So you've done all this. You've done the Hebrew type land. You've done the notebooks that fall under it. You do UX for a living. You're married. You've got, what is it, three kids?
I do have three kids.
Three kids. How old are your kids?
Turning 8, a girl, and 2 boys, 5 and 1.5.
Gotcha. I've got 7-year-old twins, so.
Oof.
Yes.
Rough stuff.
Yeah. Nah, they're good kids. Wow.
Oh, they have to be. They better be.
Yeah. That may change in about 30 minutes when it's bedtime, but. So, yeah. So you've got a full family. You're doing the side projects. This is what actually the actual point I was getting to. You know, you've got a full-time job as well. How are you finding time for work-life balance and for yourself to decompress with just turning off your brain? Do you consider that dimensional typography and things like that as that decompression, or is that something else?
Actually, yes. That is exactly why I do all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, my daily life of dealing with a family, dealing with the regular job, which is all other people's troubles, and some of my own, of course, the doing Hebrew typography for myself, and even putting together the notebooks, which is to some extent a mindless job. It's just a task of me, you know, gluing cover after another, sewing one book after the other.
Mm-hmm.
For me, that's my meditation. That's my winding down. When I get to, at night, work on all this stuff, that's how I relax. And that the reason why I'm still doing this 1.5 years later is because it's so good for my soul.
Mm-hmm.
And mind you, I am sleep deprived a little bit, but I figured out a pretty cool system around.
Well, you do have three kids too, so
I have three kids. They get up in the middle of the night sometimes, still, and all that. So what I do is, I found that if I take a nap in the evenings for like an hour and a half, which I know most people can do, but it works for me. I can do that. I take that nap. It lets me have a fresh mind, and working until about 2 o'clock in the morning, which is the best time to be creative because there's nobody around and it's quiet and I'm a night owl. So I got this kind of trick to not lose sleep and still be able to meditate and focus on all this extra work that I love doing.
Cool. So I'm going to ask you some personal questions now, since you mentioned you grew up in Israel. You've got, was it now 10 siblings?
Yep. I think my mom's done. I'm pretty sure she's passed.
You know, do your parents and your siblings all still live in Israel, or are they kind of spread out now?
All but one other one. the second child, my sister, all live in Israel. My sister actually lives about half an hour away from me, also in New Jersey.
Okay.
Which is nice. But the rest of them are still there.
Okay. Yeah. So, you know, and you can totally not answer this. Since you left, and, you know, obviously your mom wanted you to have some direction in life to, you know, call up your uncle and say, hey.
Oh, yeah.
You take him under your wing, you know, kick his butt a little bit, too.
Exactly.
He didn't,
by the way, kick my butt too much. He was such a gentle soul. He did the opposite of what I did growing up. Instead of teaching with butt kicking, he taught in love, which I never got. And that's what made me into a human being. Yeah. Non-butt kicking.
So, and I'm asking this because you mentioned when you were in school, you didn't want to learn about the Talmud. You didn't want to learn about, you know, the biblical studies that you had to do. You didn't want to learn about all of that stuff. Do you ever have conflicted moments with your faith because of that? Or is that something that you've resolved in yourself?
Oh, it's never resolved.
Yeah.
Never. There are always questions and doubts. And that's part of, you know, being faithful. It's kind of questioning yourself and then going through that.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, I was completely not religious for a long time. Mm-hmm. I've eaten bacon, for example.
It's delicious.
It's fantastic, but I don't anymore. Mm-hmm. Before I got married, I always knew that I wanted to raise a religious family. It was just what I wanted to have for myself and my kids. So, sure, I always have these questions lingering, but I believe in God, and I like being religious. The atmosphere, you know, the digital Sabbath, like the actual Sabbath that we get every week, where I spend with my family. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
It's so cool, and it's enforced, so to speak, right now because I'm religious and we keep to the faith, right? But it works out well. And
by the way, I got to ask. Sorry to interrupt on that. How does that work with an 8-year-old, a 5-year-old, and a 3-year-old in this day and age? How do you explain to them you are not allowed to turn on the TV? You are not allowed to play with your devices. The Nintendo DS has to go up. You know, how does? Because I mean, they're kids, and there is a lack of understanding just from sheer age. How does that go over?
The 1-year-old doesn't know yet.
Well, yeah. That one's the easy one.
I mean, they'll turn on their toys and play, and we'll, on, you know, on Saturday we'll have musical accompaniment thanks to him.
Mm-hmm.
But the older ones, it's not just us teaching it at home and practicing it at home. Mm-hmm. By example, they also learn that in school. They know the difference between, you know, Saturday and the rest of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And they feel it, because when you create the atmosphere that you're supposed to, which is a family time and focus on each other and that sort of a thing, you find less of a need to escape into the devices,
mm-hmm.
because you're actually paying attention to each other. Not to say that people are not during the week at all, because we also do during the week, but it's just such a high focus on just
You're forcing yourself, and I don't mean that in a bad way. I mean, you're making a conscious decision to be part of the family and to set those things aside.
It's very highly concentrated internal interactions and almost no external ones.
Mm. It'll be even more interesting when they become teenagers.
I have no idea what will happen, and, you know, if they want to do something else with themselves, it is what it is,
mm-hmm.
but I hope that they'll appreciate it enough to continue, that's all.
Yeah.
That's all I could do.
So that relationship with your parents and your siblings, how does that balance off now that, you know, you are stateside and they're still in Israel, and do you still have that relationship with them where... Well, I'm trying to find the right way to phrase it.
No, I know. I know what you're asking. It's a very potentially sensitive issue. Thankfully for me, it's not. I have so many siblings, it's kind of like, this one, that one. But
can you keep up with all of their names?
I know all their names. I don't know all their ages. I don't know all their kids' names. Some of them are married. I'll be honest here. I just don't. It's just too many.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But what I did, first of all, my youngest brother, who's now 12 or 13, see, I don't know their ages. He was born after I came to America.
Mm-hmm.
So interestingly enough, there has never been a time in our life where we were all together at the same place at the same time.
Really?
Ever. Still wow. not. Right. And this is 15 years later. Still never has been a
you got to make a point to do that at some point.
I hope to. My younger brother's getting married this summer. So if I get to go to that, that will be the first time. And I will share that photo everywhere because it's going to be an incredible moment. I mean, can you imagine not ever seeing all your siblings ever?
No. Together? But then again, I got one sibling. I got a
right.
younger brother, so that's, you know, not real tough, and he lives 45 minutes away from me, so.
Right, when you have 10 to track down, it's a slightly
yeah.
different story.
Especially when they're on different continents.
Completely, a different time zone, 7 hours yeah. difference, yeah. Which leads me to all the years before WhatsApp. I had almost no relationship with them.
Mm-hmm.
Until WhatsApp arrived on the scene.
Mm-hmm.
Once we got a family group going, it was suddenly like I had siblings again. Because for the longest time, I was too, you know, engrossed in my own life and doing whatever I was doing here. I almost never made a point to call because I also hate the phone so much. Mm-hmm. It's not for me. Part of why I'm a terrible salesman. And I didn't get a chance to talk to most of them.
Mm-hmm.
All I knew about them was from talking to my mom once in a while and kind of hearing how they're growing up.
Mm-hmm.
And so when WhatsApp arrived, I suddenly had a family again.
Mm-hmm.
And now, with WhatsApp around and go there pretty frequently, you know, we josh at one another, we poke fun, you know, there's a sibling who we all make fun of, there's a sibling who's the bully, there's a sibling who is, you know, the people already asked for money and all that. And we have that vibe going in a digital format. So that's how I maintain a relationship, and it's pretty steady and pretty cool.
Very cool.
Yeah.
So I lost my train of thought of what I was going to ask. So I know you and I talked, you know, at Creative South, and we've talked a couple other times. A large portion of my family is Jewish. It's my...
Yeah.
My dad has 4 siblings. He and his sister are the middle two, and they are a year apart. He's a year older than she is. She was married before. They got divorced when I was young, so like maybe 3 or 4. And then...
So 10 years ago.
Yeah, 10 years ago. Exactly. Yeah. I wish. I don't wish that at all, actually. But when she got married, she married a Jewish man. And he's definitely much more culturally Jewish and all that. Now, his ex-wife was from Israel, barely spoke English.
I know the type.
Was literally Miss Israel, like beauty pageant Miss Israel.
Really? She was actually Miss Israel?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Interesting.
She's also a bit crazy. But has nothing to do with the Jewish or Miss... Well, it might have to do with the Miss Israel thing. But yeah. But, you know, his son from that marriage is a year younger than me. And he went to Hebrew school. He went and lived in Israel for a few years. I think in between high school and college, he went and lived there for a few years. And then my aunt's children, my cousins, they have since, and it's not like they were raised Jewish after it was remarried, but they have both since, you know, my cousin Stacy, her husband's Jewish, and then my cousin Chris, his wife is Jewish, and Stacy, I think, is more, you know, practicing in the culturally sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But Chris and his family, you know, they go to temple almost every Saturday. You know, it's definitely a more modern temple, by the fact that he plays bass in the band at the temple.
Oh yeah, very, very different than the other extreme.
Yes. Where I came from. So, you know, so I do have some exposure to it, and then, you know, you've got my family, which, you know, we're Midwestern, you know, Lutheran people, and if you know anything about the Midwestern Protestants, is we are the worst at practicing any sort of thing. So it's almost like culturally Christian. If you
I didn't know that.
See,
I thought you were a devout man.
Or it might just be Minnesota. I don't know. But everybody I know, it was like, hey, go to church on holidays, yeah. Christmas, Easter.
They're Hallmark holidays for you.
Yeah, make an appearance the rest of the year every once in a while just so they know you're still alive. That sort of thing. So, you know, I have been exposed to it, but there's this, even with the just culturally observing it, there are differences in the culture that are around it. And you've come from this place of where you're born in America, you live here till you're 7, you move over to Israel, to an area that's obviously, I don't know what the right term for it is, but it very overzealous, I don't know if that's the right word, or...
Oh, that's a good description.
Yeah.
Go with that.
Overzealous in the amount of religion that they are observing and practicing.
Definitely.
And I don't want to say, like, it's detrimental, but there, you know, from what you were saying, there are some things that could very well be detrimental to people growing up because, you know, culture and society cannot function off just people sitting around and studying.
Oh yeah, it can be bad for a lot of the people.
Yeah,
not for everybody. Yeah, you know, their defense.
And by no means do I have any impression that all of Israel is that way.
It is not. It's very diverse.
It's a definitely melting pot and things like that. And there are, you know, just like America, there's areas where you've got different levels of it. I mean, I live in the South. We're in the Bible Belt. You know, it's you know much more that ever-present Southern Baptist guilt, which will rival the Catholic and Jewish guilt.
I don't know. Bring it on.
I can
go pretty far.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you something off air and you'll get a good laugh of it, but I'm not going to do it on air because I would like to not get my butt kicked.
Deal.
So balancing those different cultures of, you know, having grown up with that and, you know, that overzealous thing to coming to America where you have to make a conscious choice to be, you know, faithful and expose yourself to that. And to the fact that, you know, you work for a company, like you said, that is owned by Hasidim,
yep.
You know, which is a whole nother different level of, I don't know.
That's pretty much almost the edge of the spectrum.
Yeah.
Let's just say
that's where you get to that fine breaking line of,
right, they're almost at the edge. There are some who are really at the edge, but that's close to it.
Yes. You know, and I mean, there is still very much a ignorance of other people.
Yeah.
In how religions are handled, and you see it from, you know, also, I'm sure every religion in some form or fashion runs into it, and every culture runs into it, but in a long, winding way, how are you balancing those cultures of understanding and moving through those worlds and balancing all of that and finding a place and self and finding a place of self?
So for me, first of all, pretty much all of the credit goes back to my uncle. Mm-hmm. I mean, it keeps on coming back to this guy. Like I said before, he ingrained in me a love of religion, a love of other people. He always hosted everybody at his house. On Saturday, the meal there wasn't just the family. It was 20 of my friends. No exaggeration. It was lots of people coming over all the time. And it didn't matter what you did, who you were. Unless you murdered somebody, of course, right? That's bad.
That's bad.
By everybody's standards. But if you were not the same as him, it didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
And so he started ingraining in me this, you are who you are, everybody else is whoever they are, and that's just how life is. Be okay with everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty sure that I'm always like this. I mean, I'm sure I have my moments and some people will just irk me to no end, but I find myself being cool with everything and with everybody and non-judgmental and understanding. And so I do what I do for myself. I like religion. I mm-hmm. like the family life that I have. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to other people, it's not the consideration what other people are doing because it's their life, mm-hmm. right? So yeah. It doesn't affect me in sure. any way.
So unless their life directly affects yours, you're not worried about it so much.
Right. And even if it does, unless it's malicious, which well, yeah. is extremely rare,
yeah.
then whatever. You cool. know, it's perfectly okay.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, I think we should wrap it up there. That's a good way to end things. So sure. where can people...
peace and love? Definitely.
Yeah, exactly. So where can people find you online?
My handle on all social channels is the pronunciation of my name. It's actually a close approximation of the pronunciation of my name. It's E_KNOWN. Enown. Mm-hmm. I have a website which you can find through links on my social media, but on Instagram, Dribbble, Twitter, my main avenues, it's E_known. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much it.
Very cool. And HebrewType.land.
HebrewType.land.
You want to buy a nice pen or poster or awesome notebook that can be used ambidextrously?
If you're that kind of guy or gal, definitely.
Yeah, I know that's not the right word, but that was the one that popped into my head. And then when it came out, I was like, I'm going with it. Well, cool. Well, thank you, Anon. I appreciate it. Look forward to talking to you again soon.
Definitely. This was amazing, Jason. I love this podcast. I love Creative South. And really thank you for having me on here.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. You can follow Anon on Dribbble and Twitter at @E_known. And check out the show notes for more ways to interact with him. You can keep up with the podcast on Twitter at @CreativeSOPod and follow Creative South on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at @CreativeSouthGA or over at CreativeSouthGA.com. And I'm at Jay Frostholm on Dribbble, Twitter, and Instagram. Don't forget to head over to CreativeSouthGA.com right now to pick up your tickets for Creative South in April of 2017. We're looking forward to seeing you there and hugging some necks. And remember, if you like the show, help support us over at patreon.com/CreativeSouth. And if you like the Creative South podcast, head over to iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. Rate us and leave a review. This helps more people find the podcast and allows us to keep getting awesome guests. Now go out and hug some necks.